he says. "You have said what you have to say. Now listen to me. You are a man whose money is almost spent. I am a man who knows how you have spent it. You are a man who has borrowed all over Europe. I am a man who knows your creditors. One word from me, and your debts will be called in."
"Oh, and what can they do?"
Percy says. "Bankers have no armies." "Neither have you armies, my lord, if your coffers are empty. Look at me now, understand this. You hold your earldom from the king. Your task is to secure the north. Percy's and Howard's between them defend us against Scotland. Now suppose Percy cannot do it. Your men will not fight for a kind word."
"They are my tenants. It is their duty to fight."
"But, my lord, they need supply, they need provision, they need arms, they need walls and forts in good repair. If you cannot ensure these things, you are worse than useless. The king will take your title away, and your land and your castles, and give them to someone who will do the job you cannot."
"He will not. He respects all ancient titles, all ancient rights."
"Then let's say I will. Let's say I will rip your life apart, me and my banker friends. How can he explain to him? The world is not run from where he thinks, not from his border fortresses, not even from Whitehall. The world is run from Antwerp, from Florence, from places he has never imagined, from Lisbon, from where the ships with sails of silk drift west and are burned up in the sun, not from castle walls, but from counting houses, not by the call of the bugle, but by the click of the abacus, not by the grate and click of the mechanism of the gun, but by the scrape of the pen on the page of the promissory note that pays for the gun, and the gunsmith, and the powder and shot. I picture you without money and title," he says. "I picture you in a hovel, wearing homespun, and bringing home a rabbit for the pot. I picture your lawful wife, Anne Boleyn, skinning and jointing this rabbit. I wish you every happiness." Harry Percy slumps over the table. Angry tears spring out of his eyes. "You were never pre-contracted," he says. "Any silly promises you made had no effect in law. Whatever understanding you think you had, you didn't have it. And there is another matter, my lord. If ever you say one more word about Lady Anne's freedom..." He packs into one word a volume of disgust. "Then you will answer to me, and the Howards, and the Boleyns, and George Rochford will have no tender care of your person, and my Lord Wiltshire will humble your pride. And as for the Duke of Norfolk, if he hears the slightest imputation against his niece's honour, he will drag you out of whatever hole you are cowering in, and bite your bollocks off. Now," he says, resuming his former amiability, "is that clear, my lord?" He crosses the room and opens the serving hatch again. "You can peer in again now." Faces appear, or, to be truthful, just bobbing foreheads and eyes. In the doorway, he pauses and turns back to the Earl. "And I will tell you this, for the avoidance of doubt. If you think Lady Anne loves you, you could not be more mistaken. She hates you. The only service you can do her now, short of dying, is to unsay what you said to your poor wife, and take any oath that is required of you to clear her path to become Queen of England." On the way out, he says to Risley, "I feel sorry for him, really." Cormie laughs so hard, he has to lean against the wall. Next day, he's early for the meeting of the King's Council. The Duke of Norfolk takes his place at the head of the table, then shifts out of it when word comes that the King himself will preside. "And Warham is here," someone says. The door opens, nothing happens. Then slowly, very slowly, the ancient prelate shuffles in. He takes his seat. His hands tremble as they rest on the cloth before him.
His head trembles on his neck. His skin is parchment-coloured, like the drawing that Hans made of him. He looks around the table with a slow, lizard blink. He crosses the room and stands across the table from Warham, inquiring after his health by way of a formality. It is clear he is dying. He says, "This prophetess you harbour in your diocese, Eliza Barton, how is she getting on?" Warham barely looks up.
"What is it you want, Cromwell? My commission found nothing against the girl, you know that."
"I hear she is telling her followers that if the king marries Lady Anne, he has only a year to reign."
"I could not swear to that. I have not heard it with my own ears."
"I understand Bishop Fisher has been to see her."
"Well, or she to see him, one or the other. Why should he not? She is a blessed young woman."
"Who is controlling her?" Warham's head looks as if it will wobble off his shoulders.
"She may be unwise. She may be misled. After all, she is a simple country girl, but she has a gift, I am sure of it. When people come into her company, she can tell them at once what is troubling them, what sins are weighing on their conscience."
"Indeed, I must go and see her. I wonder if she would know what's troubling me." "Peace," Thomas Boleyn says. "Harry Percy is here." The Earl comes in between two of his minders. His eyes are red, and a whiff of stale vomit suggests he has resisted the efforts of his people to scrub him down. The king comes in. It is a warm day, and he wears pale silks. Rubies cluster on his knuckles like bubbles of blood. He takes his seat. He rests his flat blue eye on Harry Percy. Thomas Audley, standing in as Lord Chancellor, leads the Earl through his denials. Pre-contracted? No. Promises of any kind? No carnal, I so regret to mention, knowledge? Upon my honour, no, no, and no.
"Sad to say, we shall need more than your word of honour," the King says. "Matters have gone so far, my lord."
Harry Percy looks panic-stricken. "Then what more must I do?" he says softly. "Approach His Grace of Canterbury, my lord. He's holding out the book." This, anyway, is what the old man is trying to do. Monseigneur tries to assist him, and Warham bats his hands away. Gripping the table, making the cloth slide, he hauls himself to his feet.
"Harry Percy, you have chopped and changed in this matter. You have asserted it, denied it, asserted it. Now you are brought here to deny it again, but this time not only in the sight of men. Now will you put your hand on this Bible and swear before me and in the presence of the king and his council that you are free from unlawful knowledge of Lady Anne, and free from any marriage contract with her?"
Harry Percy rubs his eyes. He extends his hand. His voice shakes.
"I swear."
"All done," the Duke of Norfolk says. "You'd wonder how the whole thing got about in the first place, wouldn't you?"
He walks up to Harry Percy and grips him by the elbow.
"We shall hear no more of this, boy."
The king says,
"Howard, you have heard him take his oath. Cease to trouble him now. Some of you assist the archbishop. You see he is not well."
His mood softened. He smiles around at his councillors.
"Gentlemen, we will go to my private chapel and see Harry Percy take Holy Communion to seal his oath. Then Lady Anne and I will spend the afternoon in reflection and prayer. I shall not want to be disturbed."
Warham shuffles up to the king.
Winchester is robing to say mass for you. I am going home to my diocese.
With a murmur, Henry leans to kiss his ring.
Henry, the Archbishop says, I have seen you promote within your own court and council persons whose principles and morals will hardly bear scrutiny. I have seen you deify your own will and appetite to the sorrow and scandal of Christian people. I have been loyal to you to the point of violation of my own conscience. I have done much for you, but now I have done the last thing I will ever do.
At Austin Friars, Rafe is waiting for him.
Yes?
Yes.
So now?
Now Harry Percy can borrow more money and edge himself nearer his ruin. A progress which I shall be pleased to facilitate. He sits down. I think one day I will have that earldom off him.
How would you do that, sir?
He shrugs. Don't know.
You would not want the Howards to have more sway in the borders than they do already.
No. No, possibly not. He broods. Can you look out the papers about Warren's prophetess? While he waits, he opens the window and looks down into the garden. The pink of the roses in his arbours has been bleached out by the sun. I am sorry for Mary Talbot, he thinks. Her life will not be easier after this. For a few days only, she instead of Anne was the talk of the King's Court. He thinks of Harry Percy, walking in to arrest the Cardinal, keys in his hand, the guard he set around the dying man's bed. He leans out of the window. I wonder if peach trees would be possible. Rafe brings in the bundle. He cuts the tape and straightens out the letters and memoranda. This unsavoury business all started 6 years ago, at a broken-down chapel on the edge of Kentish marshland, when a statue of the Virgin began to attract pilgrims, and a young woman by name Elizabeth Barton started to put on shows for them. What did the statue do in the first place to get attention? Move, probably, or weep blood. The girl is an orphan, brought up in the household of one of Warham's land agents. She has a sister, no other family. He says to Rafe, nobody took any notice of her till she was 20 or so, and then she had some kind of illness, and when she got better, she started to have visions and speak in alien voices. She says she's seen St. Peter at the gates of heaven with his keys. She's seen St. Michael weighing souls. If you ask her where your dead relatives are, she can tell you. If it's heaven, she speaks in a high voice. If it's hell, in a deep voice. The effect could be comic, Rafe says. Do you think so? What irreverent children I have brought up. He reads, then looks up. She sometimes goes without food for 9 days. Sometimes she falls suddenly to the ground. Not surprising, is it? She suffers spasms, torsions, and trances. It sounds most displeasant. She was interviewed by my Lord Cardinal, but his hand sifts the papers. Nothing here. No record of that meeting. I wonder what happened. Probably he tried to get her to eat her dinner. She wouldn't have liked that. By this, he reads, she is in a convent in Canterbury. The broken-down chapel has got a new roof and money is rolling into the local clergy. There are cures. The lame walk, the blind see. Candles light by themselves. The pilgrims are thick upon the roads. Why do I feel I've heard this story before? She has a flock of monks and priests about her, who direct the people's eyes heavenwards whilst picking their pockets. And we can presume it is these same monks and priests who have instructed her to hawk around her opinion on the subject of the king's marriage. Thomas More has met her, as well as Fisher. Yes, I keep that in mind. Oh, and look here. Mary Magdalene has sent her a letter, illuminated in gold. Can she read it? Yes, it seems she can. He looks up.
What do you think? The king will endure being called names, if it is by a holy virgin. I suppose he is used to it. Anne berates him often enough. Possibly he is afraid. Rafe has been to court with him. Evidently, he understands Henry better than some people who have known him all his life. Indeed, he is. He believes in simple maids who can talk to saints. He is disposed to believe in prophecies, whereas I think we let it run for a time. See who visits her, who makes offerings. Certain noble ladies have been in touch with her, wanting their fortunes told and their mothers prayed out of purgatory. My Lady Exeter, Rafe says. Henry Courtney, Marquis of Exeter, is the king's nearest male relative, being a grandson of old King Edward. Hence, useful to the Emperor when he comes with his troops to boot out Henry and put a new king on the throne. If I were Exeter, I wouldn't let my wife dance attendance on some addle-witted girl who is feeding her fantasies that one day she will be queen. He begins to refold the papers. This girl, you know, she claims she can raise the dead. At John Pettit's funeral, while the women are upstairs sitting with Lucy, he convenes an impromptu meeting downstairs at Lion's Quay to talk to his fellow merchants about disorder in the city. Antonio Bonvisi, Moore's friend, excuses himself and says he will go home. "The Trinity bless and prosper you," he says, withdrawing and taking with him the mobile island of Chill, which has followed him since his unexpected arrival. "You know," he says, turning at the door, "if there is a question of help for Mistress Pettit, I shall be glad." "No need. She is left wealthy." "But will the city let her take the business on?" He cuts him off. "I have that in hand." Bonvisi nods and goes out. Surprising he should show his face. John Parnell of the Draper's Company has a history of clashes with Moore. "Master Cromwell, if you are taking charge of this, does it mean... do you have it in mind to speak to Lucy?" "Me? No." Humphrey Monmouth says, "Shall we have our meeting first and broker marriages later? We are concerned, Master Cromwell, as you must be, as the king must be. We are all, I think..." He looks around. "We are all, now Bonvisi has left us, friendly to the cause for which our late brother Pettit was, in effect, a martyr. But it is for us to keep the peace, to disassociate ourselves from outbreaks of blasphemy." In one city parish last Sunday, at the sacred moment of the elevation of the host, and just as the priest pronounced, "Hoc est enim corpus meum," there was an outbreak of chanting, "Hoc est corpus, hocus pocus." And in an adjacent parish, at the commemoration of the saints, where the priest requires us to remember our fellowship with the holy martyrs, "Cum Joanne, Stefano, Matthia, Barnaba, Ignacio, Alexandro, Marcellino, Petro," some person has shouted out, "and don't forget me and my cousin Kate, and Dick with his cockle barrel on Leadenhall, and his sister Susan, and a little dog, Posset." He puts his hand over his mouth. "If Posset needs a lawyer, you know where I am."
"Master Cromwell," says a crabbed elder from the Skinner's Company, "you convene this gathering. Set us an example in gravity."
"There are ballads made," Monmouth says, "about Lady Anne. The words are not repeatable in this company. Thomas Boleyn's servants complain they are called names on the street. Orgy are thrown on their livery. Masters must keep a hand on their apprentices. Disloyal talk should be reported."
"To whom?"
he says. "Try me." He finds Joanne at Austin Friars. She has made some excuse to stay at home, a summer cold. "Ask me what secret I know," he says. For appearance's sake, she polishes the tip of her nose.
"Let me see. You know to a shilling what the king has in his treasury?"
"I know to the farthing. Not that. Ask me."
sweet sister. When she has guessed enough, he tells her, John Parnell is going to marry Luce.
What? And John Pettit not cold?
She turns away, to get over whatever she is feeling. Your brethren stick together. Parnell's household is not clean from sectaries. He has a servant in Bishop Stokesley's prison, so I hear. Richard Cromwell puts his head around the door. Master, the tower, bricks, 5 shilling the 1,000.
No.
Right. You'd think she'd marry a safer sort of man. He goes to the door.
Richard, come back. Turns to Joanne. I don't think she knows any.
Sir?
Get it down by 6 pence and check every batch. What you should do is choose a few in every load and take a close interest in them.
Joanne in the room behind him. Anyway, you did the wise thing.
For instance, measure them. Joanne, did you think I'd get married out of some sort of inadvertence? By accident?
I'm sorry, Richard says.
Because if you keep measuring them, it throws brickmakers into a panic. And you'll see by their faces if they're trying any tricks.
I expect you have some lady in view at court. The king has given you a new office.
Clerk of the Hanoper, yes. A post in the Chancery finances. It hardly signs the flowery trail to a love affair.
Richard has gone, clattering downstairs.
Do you know what I think?
You think you should wait till she, that woman, is queen.
I think it's the transport that pushes the cost up, even by barge. I should have cleared some ground and built my own kilns.
Sunday, the 1st of September, at Windsor. Anne kneels before the king to receive the title of Marquis of Pembroke. The Garter Knights in their stalls watch her. The noble ladies of England flank her. And the Duchess, having refused and spat out an oath at the suggestion, Norfolk's daughter Mary bears her coronet on a cushion. The Howards and the Boleyns are en fête.
Monseigneur caresses his beard, nods and smiles as he receives murmured congratulations from the French ambassador.
Bishop Gardiner reads out Anne's new title. She is vivid in red velvet and ermine, and her black hair falls, virgin style, in snaky locks to her waist.
He, Cromwell, has organised the income from 15 manors to support her dignity.
A Te Deum is sung, a sermon is preached. When the ceremony is over, and the women stoop to pick up her train, he sees a flash of blue like a kingfisher, and glances up to see John Seymour's little daughter among the Howard ladies. A war horse raises his head at the sound of trumpets, and great ladies look up and smile. But as the musicians play a flourish, and the procession leaves St. George's Chapel, she keeps her pale face downturned, her eyes on her toes, as if she fears tripping. At the feast, Anne sits beside Henry on his dais, and when she turns to speak to him, her black lashes brush her cheeks. She is almost there now, almost there. Her body taut like a bowstring, her skin dusted with gold, with tints of apricot and honey. When she smiles, which she does often, she shows small teeth, white and sharp. She is planning to commandeer Catherine's royal barge, she tells him, and have the device H and K burned away, all Catherine's badges obliterated. The king has sent for Catherine's jewels, so she can wear them on the projected trip to France. He has spent an afternoon with her, 2 afternoons, 3, in the fine September weather, with the king's goldsmith beside her making drawings, and he, as master of the jewels, adding suggestions. Anne wants new settings made. At first, Catherine had refused to give up the jewels. She had said she could not part with the property of the Queen of England and put it into the hands of the disgrace of Christendom. It had taken a royal command to make her hand over the loot. Anne refers everything to him. She says, laughing, "Cromwell, you are my man." The wind is set fair and the tide is running for him. He can feel the tug of it under his feet. His friend Audley must surely be confirmed as Chancellor. The King is getting used to him. Old courtiers have resigned, rather than serve Anne. The new controller of the household is Sir William Paulet, a friend of his from Wolsey days. So many of the new courtiers are his friends from Wolsey days, and the Cardinal didn't employ fools. After the Mass and Anne's installation, he attends the Bishop of Winchester as he disrobes, gets out of his canonicals into gear more suitable for secular celebrations. "Are you going to dance?" he asks him. He sits on a stone window ledge, half attentive to what is going on in the courts below, the musicians carrying in pipes and lutes, harps and rebecs, hautboys, viols and drums. "You could cut a good figure. Or don't you dance now, you're a bishop?" Stephen's conversation is on a track of its own. "You'd think it would be enough for any woman, wouldn't you? To be made a marquess in her own right. She'll give way to him now. Air in the belly, please God, before Christmas." "Oh, you wish her success?" "I wish his temper soothed, and some result out of this. Not to do it all for nothing." "Do you know what Chapuis is saying about you? That you keep two women in your household dressed up as boys." "Do I?" he frowns. "Better, I suppose, than two boys dressed up as women." "Now that would be opprobrious." Stephen gives a bark of laughter. They stroll together towards the feast. "Trolly lolly," the musicians sing. "Pastime with good company, I love and shall until I die." The soul is musical by nature, the philosophers say. The King calls up Thomas Wyatt to sing with him, and the musician Mark. "Alas, what shall I do for love? For love, alas, what shall I do?" "Anything he can think of," Gardiner says. "There is no limit that I can see." He says, "The King is good to those who think him good." He floats it to the bishop below the music. "Well," Gardiner says, "if your mind is infinitely flexible, as yours, I see, would have to be." He speaks to Mistress Seymour. "Look," she says. She holds up her sleeves, the bright blue with which she has edged them, that kingfisher flash, is cut from the silk in which she wrapped her present of needlework patterns. "How do matters stand now at Wolf Hall?" he asks, as tactfully as he can. "How do you ask after a family in the wake of incest?" She says in her clear little voice, "Sir John is very well, but then Sir John is always very well."
"And the rest of you?"
"Edward, angry. Tom, restless. My lady mother, grinding her teeth and banging the doors. The harvest coming in, the apples on the bough, the maids in the dairy, our chaplain at his prayers, the hens laying, the lutes in tune, and Sir John, as always, is very well. Why don't you make some business in Wiltshire, and ride down to inspect us? Oh, and if the King gets a new wife, she will need matrons to attend her, and my sister Liz is coming to court. Her husband is the Governor of Jersey. You know him. Anthony Outred. I would rather go up country to the Queen, myself, but they say she is moving again, and her household has been reduced."
"If I were your father..." "No," he rephrases it. "If I were to advise you, it will be to serve Lady Anne."
"The Marquis," she says. "Of course, it is good to be humble. She makes sure we are."
"Just now, it is difficult for her. I think she will soften when she has her heart's desire." Even as he says it, he knows it is not true. Jane lowers her head, looks up at him from under her eyelids.
"That is my humble face. Do you think it will serve?"
He laughs. "It would take you anywhere."
When the dancers are resting, fanning themselves from the galliards, pavans and almands, he and Wyatt sing the little soldier's air. Scaramella to the war has gone, with his shield, his lance. It is melancholy, as songs are, whatever the words when the light is failing and the human voice unaccompanied fades in the shadows of the room. Charles Brandon asks him,
What is it about, that song? Is it about a lady? No, it is just about a boy who goes off to war. What are his fortunes?